Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, fighting inflation. The Federal Reserve implements the highest single interest rate hike in nearly 30 years to combat rising prices. Then, vote 2022. Candidates backed by former President Trump have mixed success after primaries in several key states, but his philosophy shows enduring popularity. And after the storm, thousands of Louisiana residents are still without adequate housing. 9 months after Hurricane Ida, with low-income and underserved communities hit the hardest.
The last 3 years, I've evacuated 7 times for storms, and then Ida was the worst, obviously. I'm not sure I could take another one down here, to be honest with you.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The Federal Reserve ramped up its efforts to fight inflation with a notable interest rate hike today. Officials voted to raise the Fed's benchmark rate by 0.75 point. That is a jump higher than expected just a week ago. Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell acknowledged that the ongoing series of hikes meant to tamp down inflation might also slow growth later this year. And the Fed projected unemployment would rise to 4% by 2024. Our economics correspondent Paul Solomon reports on the Fed's plan to get more aggressive.
Today's interest rate boost of 0.75%, the Fed's most dramatic since 1994. Chair Jerome Powell.
Contrary to expectations, inflation again surprised to the upside. Some indicators of inflation expectations have risen, and projections of this year have moved up notably. So we thought that strong action was warranted at this meeting, and today we delivered that.
It's to combat inflation we Americans haven't seen take off like this in 40 years. Suddenly, rents through the roof. The price of eggs up 32% over last year. Unaffordable used minivans. And filling up for that trip to the store in the car you can no longer afford, up 50% from just last year. Hey, it now costs me $80 to fill up my supposedly economical Subaru. So the typical American household is spending something like $400 to $500 more per month for the same stuff they bought last year. The Fed was planning a more modest interest rate hike, but Friday the consumer price index pinged 8.6%, forcing the Fed to adjust.
Clearly, today's 75 basis point increase is an unusually large one, and I do not expect moves of this size to be common. Our overarching focus is using our tools to bring inflation back down to our 2% goal and to keep longer-term inflation expectations well anchored.
Higher interest rates are the Fed's key inflation tool. Seth Carpenter, chief global economist at Morgan Stanley.
So what the Fed is trying to do is raise interest rates to make credit more expensive for households and businesses to borrow and then spend. And through that mechanism, bring down the amount of spending going on in the economy, and by reducing the amount of spending in the economy, try to bring down inflation.
But will it? Are the forces here, pandemic, global supply chains, war in Ukraine, simply greater than anything a central bank like the Fed can cope with?
There is no playbook that the Fed can follow, looking back over the past 10, 20, 30, even 50 years, to try to understand exactly how to navigate these times.
Rising inflation, and perhaps the Fed's reaction to it, has sent stocks tumbling, with the S&P down more than 20% from its record high, a so-called bear market that puts Wall Street, for the moment, into hibernation. The big question, how long will the inflation last? And related, how critical is the Fed to containing it? Some critics contend the Fed has done too little, too late. You one of those critics?
I think it's very easy to criticize the Fed. They're in a very, very difficult position.
But they are playing catch up.
Well, I think that's probably true. Inflation picked up very, very quickly. It seems to be very broadly based now. And there is always a lag between the increase in interest rates and the way that can slow spending in the economy, and then from slower spending in the economy to bringing down inflation.
The last great inflation surge was in the 1970s. Then Fed Chair Paul Volcker is credited with crushing it and the economy by raising interest rates as high as 20%. It's now being said that Chairman Powell is trying to pull a Paul Volcker, no?
Well, I think it remains to be seen whether a severe recession is what's critical, or if there's some slowdown in the economy that is shy of that kind of recession can do the trick in order to bring inflation down. And if anyone says they know for sure, they're either lying to themselves or they're lying to you.
There's also this to consider. Had the Fed done too much too soon, it could have choked the economy during a pandemic, killing jobs, freaking out markets, inducing a recession. Longtime economics journalist David Wessel of the Brookings Institution.
Chairman Powell at his press conference today was emphatic. He is determined to bring inflation down and particularly to prevent inflation from getting embedded in people's expectations. And he said it over and over and over again, and I think he means it.
Could he really have moved much earlier in the midst of a pandemic?
It's just that we have 8.6% inflation, and it's hard to escape the fact that the Fed's target is 2%. So they probably could have moved a little sooner. I think they've made up for it. It is a remarkably sharp shift in Fed policy in the last 6 months, the fastest I've ever seen since Paul Volcker.
So what's ahead for the Fed? More hikes this year, said Powell today, as he tries to tamp down inflation before it becomes self-fulfilling.
So thank you very much.
For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
In the day's other news, Wall Street rallied after the Fed's announcement. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 303 points, 1%, to close at 30,668. The NASDAQ rose 2.5%. The S&P 500 added 1.5%. President Biden pushed oil companies today to produce more gasoline and cut prices. He wrote to industry executives, restating his charge that they are profiteering. And he said, quote, the crunch that families are facing deserves immediate action. The industry, in turn, blamed Mr. Biden's policies for curbing production. A white man accused of fatally shooting 10 black victims at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, will face federal hate crime counts. Peyton Gendron was charged today. It came as U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland visited the memorial for the victims in Buffalo. He said there's a moral obligation to act.
In fear that they will go to work or shop at a grocery store and will be attacked by someone who hates them because of the color of their skin.
Garland did not rule out seeking the death penalty. Gendron already faces a mandatory life prison term if he is convicted on state charges. The Michigan police officer charged with murdering Patrick Leoya was fired today. Christopher Scherr shot Leoya in the back of the head after a struggle in April. The Grand Rapids police chief recommended last week that Scherr be dismissed. A federal grand jury has indicted the California man accused of plotting to murder Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Nicholas Roski was arrested last week near Kavanaugh's home in Maryland. A conviction could carry a maximum sentence of life in prison. There are new questions about Georgia Republican Congressman Barry Loudermilk leading a tour of the U.S. Capitol complex one day before the January 6th attack. The January 6th committee released video today showing some in the group photographing stairwells and tunnels. The committee chair suggested it might be suspicious. Loudermilk said it was entirely innocent.
If you go to that stairwell, there's a golden eagle sconce that's on the wall. That's what he's taking a picture of. I mean, these are folks who had never been to Washington, D.C., and they were here to visit their congressman.
The Capitol Police have said there is nothing suspicious on the video. The committee says one man on the tour was outside the Capitol the next day making threats against top Democrats. A federal judge in Washington convicted a man and his son today for January 6th crimes. A widely seen photograph shows the father, Kevin Seyfried, carrying a Confederate flag. He and his son were found guilty of obstructing an official proceeding and disorderly conduct. The nation's top pandemic expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has come down with COVID. The National Institutes of Health said today that Fauci has mild symptoms. He is 81 and has been vaccinated and boosted twice. Meanwhile, FDA advisors endorse Moderna and Pfizer vaccinations for children under five. Shots could begin on Monday if they win final approval. The United States has announced its largest military aid package yet for Ukraine. The $1 billion package includes rocket launchers and heavy artillery. In Brussels, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin confirmed the aid and the need to ship it to outgunned Ukrainian fighters soon.
When you're in the fight, you can never get enough, and you can never get it quick enough. So, but having said all that, you know, we're going to work hard to make sure we're doing everything humanly possible. We're going to continue to move heaven and earth to get them the capability that they need.
In Ukraine, Russian forces kept up a heavy bombardment in Severodonetsk after Ukrainian troops rejected an ultimatum to surrender. Back in this country, extreme heat gripped a swath of states from Florida to the Great Lakes for a second day. Forecasters warned that readings in the 90s and higher could generate severe thunderstorms tonight. The heat could begin to ease tomorrow. Record flooding this week in and around Yellowstone National Park may have altered the landscape there for good. New images show a local river shifted its course after a torrent caused by heavy rain. The water also washed out roads, damaged homes, and drove thousands of visitors away. Video from Sunday showed a rock slide striking one car as it left the park. No one was hurt. And President Biden has issued new executive orders on LGBTQ rights. Among other things, they aim to discourage so-called conversion therapy to change sexual orientation or gender identity. It's a response to state laws seen as being anti-LGBTQ. Still to come on the NewsHour, what parents need to know about the newly approved COVID vaccines for children under 5 years old. The UK tries to push ahead with its controversial plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. Why a Minnesota bank building ranks among the United States' most significant architecture, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Nearly half of the country has now chosen party nominees for November's midterm elections. Yesterday's primaries from South Carolina to Nevada made clear that for many Republicans, loyalty to Donald Trump is still the key to success. The biggest win for the former president came in the Palmetto State, where five-term incumbent Congressman Tom Rice, one of the 10 House Republicans who supported Trump's impeachment, was pushed out by pro-Trump state representative Russell Fry. The Washington Post's Annie Linsky has been following yesterday's results, and she joins me now. Welcome back to the NewsHour, Annie Linsky. So let's start by talking about these South Carolina House races. There were two of them I want to ask you about, but one, this resounding rejection of Tom Rice by voters in his Republican primary. He never backed down in his criticism of President Trump.
Now, that's right. He essentially doubled down, employing a different strategy than we've seen with other Republicans who have gotten the ire of Trump. He said that he voted to impeach the president and continued to talk about it on the trail. He said to one of my colleagues, calling Trump a tyrant. And the former president reads this coverage very closely. Yeah. So he continued at it, and he attracted a Trump-backed challenger. And we saw him lose. I mean, we had gone into yesterday thinking perhaps it would go to a runoff, but it was a resounding defeat.
2-1. But different story in another South Carolina district we've been watching, Representative Nancy Mace. She didn't vote to impeach President Trump, but she did side with Vice President Pence in saying that he couldn't certify or couldn't refuse to certify the 2020 election results. Former President Trump didn't like that. He went after her. But she continued to say nice things about him in her race, even though she wasn't endorsed by him.
Right. And had a different result. I mean, she also had a primary challenger who was also backed by Trump. So it's not as if Trump really accepted the sort of olive branch that she reached out to him with. But on the trail, her posture was really different. And she kept on saying good things about him. She, you know, went to Trump Tower and famously recorded a video explaining why she's with him and why his supporters should back him. So she really kind of bowed down to him in a way that Rice did not. And then you saw very different results where she was able to stay in power and he was not. And I think what's emerging here is a potential playbook for Republicans who do somehow, you know, cross Trump in some ways. If they stand up to him, they better very quickly turn around and, you know, try to make amends.
And, of course, depending on how they read their constituents, you know, in their district or their state.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Nevada now. We're looking at a couple of statewide races there, Senate, governor, and then the Secretary of State. This is where former President Trump's endorsements, a clear plus, Adam Laxalt running for the Senate, eagerly endorsed by, lashed himself to President Trump. And then a really, talk about that, but also really interesting Secretary of State candidate.
I mean, I hate to do this, but coming out of Nevada, you know, Donald Trump really did have a royal flush. I mean, every person he endorsed ended up advancing. And, you know, the Laxalt seat is particularly interesting. That's the Senate primary. And, you know, he was backed not only by Trump, but also by Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., who in the last sort of moments of the campaign, the last days of the campaign, went out there, campaigned with him. And so what you're seeing in Nevada is Donald Trump Jr. also sort of establishing a power base of his own. He did the same thing in Ohio, where he went out and really went in big for J.D. Vance, and there was a success there, too. And then the Secretary of State race, I mean, that's really the one to watch, I think. I mean, you know, we're not used to paying close attention to Secretary of State races.
For sure.
I mean, I think most people probably didn't know what that position did before 2020. But in this case, a Secretary of State race who's an Secretary of State candidate who is an election denier and has organized other election deniers around the country to run in Secretary of State races.
He's played an active role. Jim Marchand.
Jim Marchand won last night. And I think that is something that the sort of pro-democracy groups they were watching that race closely and are really worried about his advance, because it changes the way that, you know, Nevada is a swing state, and he will have an incredible amount of influence over how Nevada's election is run in 2024.
Because the role of
Secretary... If he wins.
But the role of Secretary of State is typically to oversee elections, which could have huge consequences. In this November. A couple of things I want to ask you about, but you've been doing some really interesting reporting in the last few days, Annie Linsky, about in a few states, a few places around the country, Democrats, we know they're going to be running ads against Republicans, but they are running ads in some places for Republicans who they think may be a weaker opponent in the fall.
This has been a tactic that I've been really astounded by. On the one hand, you do have Democrats doing the January 6th committee hearings, talking about democracy, about the importance of drawing a line between, as Biden calls them, ultra-MAGA candidates. But some of the Democratic election committees are running ads to help promote the far-right candidates, believing they'll be a little easier to beat in November. You know, Democratic strategists that I've talked to say that this is a very dangerous game, and you have to be careful what you wish for. And you'll remember, of course, you know, Hillary Clinton thought that Donald Trump would be easy to beat, and that wasn't the case. So when you play these games, you do need to be careful.
You're taking a risk. It's not something that we have seen it before in American politics.
Yes.
But right now, it's something we are keeping a very close eye on. Annie Linsky, The Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
A bipartisan group of lawmakers on Capitol Hill has agreed to a framework to reform the Electoral Count Act. Now, this is the law that governs the way Congress counts and certifies Electoral College votes during the presidential election. And it has become the subject of scrutiny after the January 6th attack on the Capitol. For more on all this, I'm joined by our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins. So, Lisa, remind us of what this act does, what this issue is all about, and what this group is looking to do.
This is the act that goes back to the 1880s after the tumultuous 1876 election led to all kinds of problems with different competing slates of delegates and electors. This law was put in place to try and have a very clear process for exactly how the Electoral College certification was done. It spells out what Congress's role is, exactly what happens, exactly what was supposed to happen on January 6th, what the role of the vice president is, all of that. But because this particular law, rarely seen or rarely brought up, is murky in some ways, it led to those questions on January 6th and conspiracy theories that it could be changed, and also opened the door for objections in Congress itself. So let's look at what the situation is now and what this framework of reform would do. Right now, under the Electoral Count Act, in order to trigger a challenge to an electoral count, it just requires one member of the House and one member of the Senate to challenge any particular state's slate of electors. What this framework would do is radically change that to require 20% of each chamber must object to that state's slate of electors in order to trigger a challenge. Also now in the Electoral Count Act, it does state that the vice president, as the president of the Senate, really announces the count, has a role, but it's vague. It's not clear exactly what the vice president's limits are. No one's ever had a problem with that before until this past 2020 election. What this would do is it would clarify, make it very clear that the vice president only has a ceremonial or ministerial role, as some of these folks are saying. The agreement here, Judy, also would have some money to help for security for state elections officials, something I know the two of you were just talking about as well.
For sure. And Lisa, tell us what the timeline is for this, because as you say, right now, what you're seeing is a framework, not legislative language yet.
This is fascinating. One reason it's taken a little longer on this is because there aren't really any experts on this. No one from the Arthur or Grover Cleveland administrations is still around to help lawmakers figure out how this should work. But I was told by one senator and by several offices today that they think they can get text for this ready by August. So the question is then, when would there be a vote? You know, there's some politics here, Judy. I believe that we would have to see a vote perhaps after the election itself. One, because Democrats, many of them, think that this kind of bill should include voting rights, and they might have a problem with it before the election if it doesn't. Then Republicans on their side, they know this kind of bill may raise some ire from the Trump side of their party. They don't want to do that. So while this could be ready to go before then, could have the support, we may not see a full vote in the Senate for a few months. We'll watch it.
And Lisa, as you say, this is not a law that had gotten a great deal of attention before it was taken, I think it's fair to say, for granted. Remind us, though, why this is something that matters so much.
I think your segment just now showed exactly what's going on. There are candidates running right now for Congress who deny the 2020 election and who would use something, perhaps, like the Electoral Count Act. Now, if you look at this map, this is data from the Washington Post. This shows the primaries up until now. You can see in all of those states that are red, that's how many Republican nominees for the House, they've won their primary, deny the 2020 win by Joe Biden or question it. These are people who would sit in Congress and under current law would have the right to object to, say, another election if President Trump runs again. So this is something that is not just theoretical. This is something that the Electoral Count Act could very well affect the next election. Also interesting to note, Vice President Pence's role, one of his closest advisors, Michael Luttig, also a well-known conservative judge, has been speaking out about this and what was leading up to January 6th. He spoke to Frontline for an upcoming documentary. Here's what he said about the theories going up to January 6th.
The plan was to overturn the election through the exploitation of what I've called the institutions of democracy and the instruments and instrumentalities of our democracy. And we know now there's no question about it. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they believed it.
Judy, this is the theme, and he will be one of the witnesses at tomorrow's committee hearing for the Select January 6th committee.
For sure. It doesn't get any more critical than this. Lisa Desjardins, we thank you. As we reported, COVID vaccines for children under five could be available as early as next week, now that the FDA has given its stamp of approval. Many parents and caregivers of the youngest have long awaited this and argue that they've had to wait too long. But even so, there are big questions about how widely the vaccines will be taken up. William Brangham has the latest.
Judy, that FDA committee unanimously approved kids' vaccines from both Moderna and Pfizer today. Pfizer's is given in three shots, Moderna's in two, and at slightly different dosages. There are approximately 18 million kids in this age group who would be eligible to get the shots. For some insight into this moment, I'm joined by Dr. Andrea Singh. She's the chief of pediatrics at Park Nicolet Clinics and Hospital in Minnesota. Hello, Dr. Singh. Welcome to the NewsHour. Could I just get your reaction to today's development?
Yeah, I'm very excited. As you said, there have been 18 million children in our country that really haven't had an option of having a vaccine. And so this unanimous approval of both Moderna and Pfizer today is really exciting news for a lot of parents.
And do you feel confident that the safety data is clear for both of these vaccines, that this is the right call for kids?
Yeah, I think I am very confident. And it really meant a lot that there was a unanimous vote of confidence in the data that was submitted thus far. As always, we are going to have to continue to look at the data as more and more kids get the vaccine and make sure that what we see in this initial sample size is actually holding true. But I feel very comfortable offering this vaccine to my patients and family members that haven't had the option yet.
What about choosing which vaccine? Does it matter, Moderna or Pfizer? Does the two-shot versus three-shot factor into your recommendations at all?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. These two vaccines were not studied head-to-head, and they pointed that out in some of the committee hearings today. So you really can't make a direct comparison. I think there are some families that will choose to do the two-dose series of Moderna, which is a higher strength, but only two doses were studied. Other families will choose to go with Pfizer, which is a lower dose, but three vaccines kind of spread out.
There is, I'm sure, a slice of parents who are, as we speak, calling your office to make appointments as quickly as possible to get their children vaccinated. But not everyone is as eager, as you well know. How do you talk with a parent who is more in the camp of, I'm just going to wait and see, I'm not so sure, I'm not sure I'm going to do this just yet?
Yeah, it's a super important conversation. And I do encourage parents, if you are kind of sitting on the fence, make that appointment with your child's healthcare provider so that you can have that discussion, because it is really important to talk through it with a professional that knows kind of the science and background and your own child's personal history. Right, a recent Family Pfizer Foundation study showed that 18% of families were super eager and calling right away to get the vaccine once it was approved. But 38% of parents were kind of in that camp that you're describing. And then the rest kind of said, yeah, no, not for us. As a pediatrician, I've been talking with my families of younger children for months, even years at this point in time, about the pros and cons of a potential vaccine for this age group. I think one thing that's super important to call out is that there's a misconception out there that COVID isn't dangerous for children. And, you know, a lot of kids have already had it and they've been fine and it's a little cold and so they don't need the vaccine. But the data shows that while only 3% of COVID cases have been in this young child age group, those kids tend to get more serious complications, more hospitalizations, and more long-term issues. So really important vulnerable group that we're talking about, this 6 month to 5 year or 6 year age group.
What if a parent comes to you and says, well, my kid recently had COVID, they've gotten over it now, and so don't they have protection, and thus I don't need the shot? What do you tell them?
Inevitably, everybody's body does mount some immune response after a COVID infection. However, that immunity really, the length of the, how long the immunity lasts really varies from person to person. And so we in the medical community do recommend getting the vaccine series started, even if you have had an infection.
What about this other risk that some people might have heard about, especially with regards to males, which is this heart condition, myocarditis? Does the data indicate that this is an issue with these vaccines for kids?
it's a really important topic that they discussed in review of the data that came forth over the last couple of days. And fortunately, there were not cases of myocarditis that were seen in the studies that have been done. It is something we're going to have to watch very closely as we move forward. What we do know and what we can extrapolate from the older kids that have gotten myocarditis related to vaccine is that it's actually 5 to 10 times more likely to get myocarditis from COVID illness itself than from the vaccine. So, you know, whenever we hear this stuff, it's super scary. We only want to do the right things for our kids. And it's really important to put the information that you're hearing into context about, you know, viruses cause myocarditis. That is something well known in the pediatric medical community. Obviously, we don't want to be the ones inducing it, but fortunately, it did not seem like that was common in the data that was studied.
All right, Dr. Andrea Singh, pediatrician and chief of pediatrics at Park Nicolet Clinics and Hospitals, thank you so much for your help.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party are facing criticism over a new migration deal with Rwanda. As part of a resettlement plan, migrants who arrive illegally on British shores would be flown 4,000 miles south to Rwanda for processing and resettling. But the first flight scheduled to depart yesterday was canceled. Amna Nawaz has the story.
The plane was ready, the tarmac clear. But the first flight scheduled to take asylum seekers from Britain to Rwanda yesterday was canceled minutes before takeoff. Over 30 people were expected to be transferred under a sweeping new immigration policy, but a ruling by the European Commission for Human Rights halted deportations.
These repeated legal barriers.
Still in the House of Commons today, British Home Secretary Priti Patel said the government will press on with their plan.
We believe that we are fully compliant with our domestic and international obligations, and preparations for our future flights and the next flights have already begun.
In April, the UK and Rwanda brokered a deal to send asylum seekers on one-way tickets to the East African nation, where their asylum applications would be processed. Proponents say this would deter criminal gangs from trafficking people and stop illegal migration into the UK, much of it across the English Channel.
Their argument is that if people think they're going to be sent 4,000 miles away, then they won't even attempt to make the crossing.
Daniel Sohedge is an expert on international refugee law and campaign manager for the group Love 146 UK, an international human rights organization. He says the policy is in line with the government's post-Brexit agenda.
They want to reduce the number of people coming into the UK seeking asylum, and control borders is the line which is used quite often. Ever since the Brexit referendum, this has been a major key point for the government, and they've just gradually increased the hostility of immigration policies.
Under the new policy, the UK has offered Rwanda over $150 million to house refugees in facilities like this one, with up to 5 years of support. Rwanda's already home to over 130,000 migrants and refugees. And yesterday, Yolanda Makolo, a government spokesperson, defended the deal.
We don't think it's immoral to offer a home to people, something that we have done here for more than 30 years.
Shame on you!
Inside the UK, the issue has divided public opinion. Cross-country protests erupted earlier this week, urging the government to drop the deal. Activists also worry about Rwanda's human rights record. The head of the UN's refugee agency, Filippo Grandi, denounced the plan as irresponsible.
I think we've been so clear over the last few weeks that we believe that this is all wrong. This is all wrong, this deal, for so many different reasons.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he is standing his ground.
But what we're going to get on and do, Mr. Speaker, is continue to take the tough decisions to take this country forward, and decisions that are on the side of the British people.
A July hearing will decide the policy's legality. Meanwhile, the fate of many asylum seekers in the UK hangs in the balance.
For more on this, I'm joined by Zoe Gardner from the Joint Counselor for Welfare of Immigrants. Her organization is among those representing the potential deportees, which won yesterday's legal case. Zoe Gardner, welcome to the NewsHour, and thank you for joining us. So your group represented two people, I believe, who were on that flight yesterday, as we just reported, canceled within just a few minutes before it was scheduled to take off. Take me inside that kind of flurry of case-by-case appeals that unfolded in the last few days. How did it come down to the last minute like that?
Oh, well, it's an extremely stressful situation, especially not least, of course, for the refugees themselves and for their family members, some of whom are here in the UK, who are seeing, you know, the people that they want desperately to be reunited with snatched away. The reason why it comes down to the last minute like that is that the government only has to provide notification of a deportation 5 days before it actually happens. So then they complain that there's all these last minute legal challenges. But the reality is that people don't have an opportunity before that. And it really does go down to the line very often.
So tell me about those two clients. Where are they from? Why were they in the UK? And what would a deportation to Rwanda have meant for them?
Well, one of them's a Kurdish Iraqi and one of them's a Syrian young man. The Syrian man was targeted by the regime in Syria. He had to run away at a moment's notice. There's no safe route, no visa to travel to the UK in order to claim asylum. But he has two sisters living here in the UK. And when my colleague told him about the letter, you know, he was like, I've received this letter. What does it mean? What is it telling me about my life? And she said to him, it means you're going to be sent to Rwanda. He said to her, what's Rwanda? And I think it just takes an incredibly enormous level of callousness not to engage with the humanity of that situation. We're talking about a refugee who has escaped devastation and war, who has come to our country to seek our protection. And we're proposing to just tear his life away and send him off on a one-way ticket around the world to a country that we can basically bribe economically because we're so much richer than them to take in the people that we don't want. It's not okay. And it makes the Rwandan government, which, by the way, is not a democracy, it's not a country where political dissent is tolerated, you know, it gives them a propaganda coup. They can say they're partnering with the United Kingdom government and they're helping to deal with this issue. And it makes them look good, but it makes us look terrible. And we really, really shouldn't be engaging in this with any other country, really. The right place for refugees who are trying to get to the UK to have their asylum cases heard is here in the UK.
And we should note some refugees, many refugees are allowed in. I mean, on the one hand, in this moment, you have the UK creating what I understand to be a special visa program to welcome people from Ukraine who are fleeing war, thousands of people, tens of thousands. And on the other hand, you have this deportation flight, which consisted, correct me if I'm wrong, mostly of people from Iraq and Afghanistan and Sudan, and the UK saying you are not allowed to stay here. You have to go to Rwanda to seek asylum. So how does the government answer to something that seems very obviously like a racist double standard?
Well, it absolutely seems to people up and down the UK like a racist double standard. It absolutely is. There's no reply to that. The government set in place a visa, as you say, for Ukrainians to come here. And within 5 minutes of them putting that online, 100,000 people in the UK had volunteered to offer up their homes to welcome people from Ukraine fleeing that war. People, you know, fleeing Syria, the same bombs Putin has attacked, you know, cities and communities in Syria, just as he has in Ukraine. But those people have no visa route to come to the UK. And so they are forced into these desperate journeys that enrich smuggling gangs. And what we need to do is actually introduce safe routes for everybody to have an accessible asylum system for all, because we really welcome the warmth that has been shown to Ukrainian refugees. But it isn't right that people from the Middle East and from Africa and, you know, black and brown people are being treated so differently and so cruelly.
So what's happening politically and culturally in the UK right now that would create conditions where this kind of policy is accepted? Politicians think that this is the time to push forward with it, as the Home Secretary says that they will.
The Prime Minister's position is actually really hanging by a thread right now. He's been exposed for having broke the laws he made during our lockdown to protect us all from the COVID pandemic. He broke the law during his time in office, and then he lied to us about it and said there were no parties when it turns out there was party after party during lockdown. And obviously the faith of the public has just gone way down in terms of trust in our politicians and trust in the Prime Minister. And so he's trying to shore up his position, change the conversation, talk about something different. Oh, look over there. There's some foreigners. We should blame them for our problems. So I really do hope that the courts will find that this is very clearly against the letter of the Refugee Convention and therefore that it's illegal.
That is Zoe Gardner from the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants joining us tonight. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Atlantic hurricane season started June 1st, but people in southeast Louisiana are still recovering after being hit last year by one of the strongest hurricanes ever to make landfall in the state. Communities correspondent Robbie Chavez went back to visit the rural coastal areas where Hurricane Ida's 150-mile-per-hour winds left behind a housing crisis.
9 months after Hurricane Ida hit her neighborhood in Terrebonne Parish, Precious Shepherd still has no electricity.
Still running a generator, not being able to store food the way I used to, eating fast food daily. It's like I'm still living in the storm.
After Ida, this entire affordable housing complex was deemed uninhabitable, and most of Shepherd's neighbors moved away.
It feels like a ghost town.
What has kept you here?
I actually had nowhere else to go. So when I came home and seen my unit wasn't as damaged, I was like, well, you know, stay home.
And amid a driver shortage, her school bus driving job was busier than ever. But the single parent's $23,000 a year salary is hardly enough to cover the daily cost of eating out or the gas-guzzling generator.
It normally runs about 16 hours. Before it runs out of gas and have to be filled.
And how much does that gas cost?
About $50 to $60.
That's per day. In an area with a poverty rate around 15%, Ida has had a lasting impact on those who can least afford it, especially when it comes to stable housing. Ursula Ward stayed here because she feared she couldn't easily access health care elsewhere.
I have heart issues, I have fibromyalgia, and I have digestion issues. And I would have to go try to find those kind of doctors in a new location all over again.
But with most of her neighbors gone and no working street lights, she doesn't feel safe at night.
It scares me with the darkness back here, not knowing if nobody's there, not knowing who's watching me when I'm leaving and coming home.
It's unsettling for Ward, who lives by herself.
Do you kind of feel left alone here?
I'm very alone. I cry most of the time. Like right now, I'm starting to get emotional, but I'm trying to like not cry right now, but it's just hard. It's just like kind of hard to deal with.
In hard-hit Cocodrie, a coastal fishing village just south of New Orleans, Heather Young, her fiancé, her children and grandchildren are among about 8,000 Louisiana households still in trailers provided by FEMA and the state.
It's been like the hardest thing I've ever did and been through, you know, and losing everything. We threw all our clothes, toys, furniture, appliances, everything had to go.
The family of seven set up camp next to their ravaged home on the water where Young's fiance works as a fisherman.
I've never actually seen underneath the tarps. And the other day I did and I just cried. It's very heartbreaking to see home like that.
Just down the road, Cecil Laprouse's store has been an anchor of this community for over 100 years.
The biggest item here is gasoline. Gasoline, bait, refreshments.
But the store remained closed while 70-year-old Laprouse spent his retirement savings on repairs.
It's a lot of work plus a lot of mental stress.
And how much money have you kind of put into the recovery?
I'd want to say close to probably 100, you know, close to 100,000, you know.
That's out of pocket cash.
Out of pocket.
Laprouse could not afford insurance, so he says he spent his own money at a time when the shuttered store brought in no income. But at least, he says, his house is livable.
We never lived like this before.
In Raceland, Cherokee Bradley is making do in a badly damaged home. Her mom, who lives next door, says she needs help to fix her home, too.
She wrote a letter to FEMA and she got denied. And they keep telling her she has insurance and she doesn't.
As for Cherokee and her three kids,
their solution was to find someone to stay with or a relative or that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, but who? Because everybody's suffering right now.
FEMA says it has paid out over $1.2 billion in recovery funds, including more than $700 million for housing assistance. But residents and advocates say it's still not reaching some of the most vulnerable.
Recovery is a very long and difficult process. It takes years.
FEMA Federal Coordinating Officer John Long.
We can't wave a wand and put things back the way they were. There are unmet needs. There was not enough affordable housing before the disaster. And so when a hurricane comes and destroys that, it just becomes a very difficult situation. And that's part of why recovery takes so long.
What do you say to your own people that said, we are struggling?
It's always a struggle. And I can't tell you that we dropped any one particular ball. There are a couple of hundred people, just FEMA people, working to coordinate and make this entire mission work.
Adding to the difficulty, says Lafourche Parish Administrator Mitch Ogeron, critical infrastructure still needs to be fixed.
We have some pump stations that were damaged. We need to be able to pump the water when it rains.
Forecasters expect this to be an above-average hurricane season, and that could mean trouble for places like coastal Louisiana, where so many people are still reeling from Hurricane Ida.
Even in non-hurricane storms, Heather Young feels unsafe in her temporary trailer.
If the wind gets too bad, it feels like you're going to flip. You
know, so it's shaking?
It shakes. If the wind's bad, it does.
So you don't even stay in there sometimes?
No. We take the kids and we'll come to the car. Feel safer in there because it don't shake, and in case we'd have to leave.
You could just get going.
Yeah.
FEMA warns nobody should ride out a hurricane in a trailer.
We make a point of telling people when they move into a FEMA unit, if the parish tells you to evacuate, evacuate.
With so many still in trailers, Ogeron says they'll have to evacuate almost double the number of people if a hurricane hits Lafourche Parish.
And one of the things that we have to consider is how do we move those people if we have a hurricane? Certainly can't ride a hurricane out in a camper. It certainly weighs heavy.
Cecil Laperouse's grandfather built his store in 1914.
It's a big tradition, and you know, it's heritage. That's the big thing of what's making me go and keep going.
He finally reopened on Memorial Day, but he says he simply can't take another destructive hurricane.
I'm not going to try it again. I'm not going to try and redo it again, you know, because I mean, this is a lot.
Not doing it.
I wouldn't do it again.
Commercial crabber Chad Canizero, who is still rebuilding his house, told us the same thing.
The last 3 years, I've evacuated 7 times for storms, and then Ida was the worst, obviously. I'm not sure I can take another one down here, to be honest with you.
With so much uncertainty remaining this hurricane season, the state plans to have extra evacuation shelters due to the high number of people still dealing with unstable housing. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Robbie Chavez in coastal Louisiana.
It turns out that the National Farmers Bank in Owatonna, Minnesota, is one of the most significant architectural works in the nation, part of the Prairie School of Design. Kayomi Lee of Twin Cities PBS went to see why this 1908 building on the National Register of Historic Places continues to attract tourists from around the nation and the world. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
There is a building in Owatonna that looks like a jewel box. Arched windows, warm terracotta flourishes, not afraid of color. It's now a Wells Fargo Bank, but it started out under a different name.
There is no more significant building in the United States. This is one of probably the top 10 most important buildings in the whole country. And that is because of Louis Sullivan.
Sullivan was a brash architect in Chicago who was all about anti-establishment architecture. He had some successes and also problems with money and drinking. But Sullivan's ideas found a fan in an Owatonna banker named Carl Kent Bennett.
He came up with it. It is form follows function. In other words, the shape of the building, the form of the building, should grow out of the function of the building. We have a perfect example of it right here. What is the function? It is a bank for farmers.
Bennett wanted it to be a place farmers would feel at home, not a Greco-Roman stately building with columns. And that was right up Sullivan's alley.
This is all about the people. It comes up from the bottom, not down from the top. This was very successful. It always has been a bank that people loved to bring their money to.
Sullivan's drinking left much of the work to chief draftsman George Grant Elmsley. And Elmsley's optimism and artistry is everywhere, like in this beautiful art glass.
There are two design elements that I think are most interesting in the bank. And one of them is this form, which I see about 20 of in each of the windows, and there are dozens more in the electroliers. They look like this. They have four lobes sticking out, and they actually represent humankind. I think of them as a representation of the human soul. And so what is Elmsley doing? He is putting these representations of humanity inside of a growing thing, inside of a plant. So he's showing us the relationship between humans and nature.
The electroliers are made of terracotta, an ode to plant life. They almost grow from the ceiling. And there's another theme at play.
All over the place, you see little boxes inside of other boxes. They're in the windows. In the president's office, we have very complicated boxes within boxes within boxes within boxes. There's like four layers of it. This all grows from an idea called the fourth dimension.
Dimensions of length, width, and height were known. But at the time, a fourth dimension of space was an exciting theory. It was a metaphor for an expanding consciousness, and it's clear it was on Elmsley's mind. Though Elmsley carried most of the weight, Sullivan is not entirely absent. An arched window is reminiscent of Sullivan's transportation building in Chicago. The bank cost $125,000, a huge sum in 1908. What's extraordinary is that much of the original works remain today. Some beautiful original features are gone. This is a reproduction of one of the iron teller cages, possibly the most revered design element in the entire bank. It would be nearly the last hurrah for Sullivan and Elmsley together. Sullivan fired Elmsley the following year in a bitter parting. The bank itself went belly up 18 years later. But even with this disastrous backstory, the building has remained beloved by the community.
People have been proud of this bank in Owatonna ever since, and they love it. They think of it as their town symbol. It's the most important thing to the world that exists in Owatonna.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kayomi Lee in St. Paul.
And my apologies, it's Owatonna. I mispronounced it when I introduced that story. And with that, that's the NewsHour for tonight. We thank you for joining us, and please watch our coverage tomorrow morning of the January 6th committee hearings at 1 o'clock. I should say 1 o'clock Eastern. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and good night. Please stay safe.